Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. Respondent, Leonore Elkus, at 220 North Bithridge Street, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Interviewer, Rhea C. Lima and Florence Joseph. The date is May 9th. Background or career?
Well, he died very young. He died at the age of 40, very suddenly. He was an only son. His name was Harold A. Rosenbaum. And he was a Hotchkiss and Yale graduate. And in the years that he was alive, he was very active with Yale. He became one of their officers. And he also was first in the business that his father had bought him, which was a department store, and which he never wanted to do, which he told me, he died when I was 12 and my sister was 6, but he told me this on our walks to school. He said that he didn't have the heart to tell his dad he didn't want the store because his father was so proud of him and wanted him to have this, and he himself had been in the business of a department store and export-import business before he semi-retired. That's my grandfather, his father, and went instead into real estate. So he never did tell him, but what he had really wanted to be was a doctor. And he kept the store for a number of years, and then it was a year before he died, he had definitely decided to sell the store, and he was going to go into banking. He'd already been offered. He was a very handsome and charming young man, and he was offered a job in one of the large banking investment firms in New York City, and he would have gone in there. And on a first long vacation that he had taken in many years, he died in Europe, suddenly of a heart attack, dropped dead. And so my sister and I knew him very little, only to the age of 12 for me and 6 for her.
I see.
As for my mother, she was, of course, she was alive till she was 87, and she was a great leader singer, as perhaps you already know. Her name was Hulda Lashanska, and she was Marcella Zembrich, as Zembrich said herself, her favorite pupil. And mother had been, well, let's put it this way, her beautiful voice was really discovered by her piano teacher, who was a very famous piano teacher in New York and a close friend of both Hoffman and Rachmaninoff. His name was Alexander Lambert. And he heard her sing one day while she was studying and playing a piece for him on the piano. And he said, "Child, sing some more for me." And he made her sing a song. He says, "You ought to study voice. I'm going to tell your parents that you must know piano if you should study anything else, but you should study voice." So, at his suggestion, she sang for Marcella Zembrich, who never took a single voice student, and she was one of the famous opera singers of a generation, without their knowing three languages, playing the piano or another musical instrument, and being well acquainted with music generally.
How old was your mother at this time?
Oh, she was then about 17.
I see.
And then what she did, after seeing Zembrich said to her, "I am not a voice builder. That's what you must do first. You have the voice. You go into opera, leader, singer, whatever you want. But you have the voice, but you need voice building," and sent her to Madame Ashworth, who was a great voice builder, probably the best one in New York at the time, who accepted her. And my mother began to study singing, but she didn't leave Lambert. She kept learning piano. Well, she had it pretty well, and she could play anything she wanted on sight, and she could also play by ear.
I see. Did you or your sister inherit any of that gift?
Well, to some extent, but not to her extent, because she was so good that when she left the Ashford studio and began to coach with Sembry, she had also a scholarship to Hunter.
I see.
And she got through Hunter also, because in those days, as she said very honestly, if your general average was over 85, you passed. And she said the only thing that brought her down was math, which she barely passed, and I certainly inherited that. Did you? How nice. That's great. That's great. You must give me a signal if the tape's running out. Okay, and what happened then was, you see, that she had, she studied at Hunter, she graduated from Ashley's studio, and then she had a couple of years of work with Zembrich, a year abroad, where she and another very famous singer who were good friends, Sophie Braslau, who sang in opera and was a contralto, they went to Europe together and studied for a year with Plançon, who was a very famous French tenor in opera, and they studied abroad together. And then after that, she had her debut in Town Hall, and it was a very, very successful one. And after that, she was launched on a lead singing career. Perhaps you'd like to know, which I think is rather interesting, that her mother, particularly more than the father, opposed the idea of her going on the stage bitterly. You know, you have certain middle class values, and in those days, which would be hard for you or for me to believe, but they were that way, a woman on the stage was considered practically a fallen woman or déclassée, even though this was leader singing, which was, of course, quite comme il faut in other parts of the world. So it took her mother's brother, who was a leader in the financial world of Chicago, his name was Moses Bourne, and he was devoted to my mother, and helped her in many, many ways. He was the one who persuaded his sister that his niece would not be a fallen woman if she would study leader singing. So eventually she gave in, and this debut, which was highly successful, launched Mother on her career in singing.
That's most interesting. Was she born in New York City also?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And that's where your parents met, I gather.
Yes, they did.
And where did they settle in New York in the early years of their marriage?
Oh, yes, they did. They had a nice apartment and then another. Then when my grandfather, my father's father, became ill and could not climb stairs, and I guess in those days they didn't have many elevators for houses, they gave the house. Rather, I'll put it this way, he and his wife gave the house to my mother after my father died. And so we moved into a really old brownstone house at 85th Street, which my grandfather had built for my grandmother as a wedding gift when he married her, because he was about 14 years her senior. And he was already a well-known merchant in New York when he married her. And she was about 19. She used to look more like my father, like his sister, than his mother. She was slim and very lovely.
Were your grandparents then from New York City also?
These were my grandparents.
Were they born in New York City? Some of them were.
My father's mother was the descendant of our first ancestor in the United States. She was not only born in New York, and her parents, and her great-grandparents, and so forth. The family had originally come from Portugal and Spain, and they moved to Holland. And my first ancestor there was a man named David Crommelin. And as my sister said, well, we must be legitimate, because he was a mustard and chocolate merchant, and my sister likes mustard and I love chocolate. So anyway, he came to the United States about 1770 and settled in Philadelphia, was married. However, his wife died of yellow fever. Perhaps you all know that the swamps of Philadelphia were full of yellow fever mosquitoes, and they didn't know that, of course. And yellow fever would run through like a plague for a while. So after she died and there was no issue, then he moved to New York and married a Nathan. And we're all descendants of that man. And now you're asking about the others. I'll tell you about them because we think we're rather an international hodgepodge. I'm thinking now, this was Grandmother Rosenbaum, who had been a spirit. And then there was my grandfather, Thalic, who came to this country and whom I worshipped and never known a finer man. He came over in 1830 at the age of 16. And he had a letter from an uncle from the town where he came from, which was Würzburg, Germany, to a friend of his who had settled in New York and had a big department store. And grandfather began to work for him at age 16, far from his kin. And he told me he got $6 a week, which was considered a very liberal beginning salary, of which he saved $2, spent $2 for room and board, and $2 for food. And that's what he started with. Obviously, you can see there wasn't too much left for things like clothing or fun
luxuries
or pleasure, but this must have been the going wage in those days. Now, my grandmother, Lashanska, was born a Born. Remember I mentioned Moses Born. She came from Mannheim. That was a very well-known family there in Mannheim, Germany. And she married Henry Lashanska, who was my mother's father.
That's an unusual name.
Yes, and I'll tell you about that because, of course, his name was Lashansky. He came from Prague in Czechoslovakia. Men's names end with Y, women's K-A. And naturally, mother used this because it was her real maiden name on the stage. And he came from an extremely old Jewish family in Prague. And as you know, that was all part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I'm sure you all know that. And one branch of the family at the time of the Inquisition changed to Catholicism, and the other branch remained Jewish. And they are all related, even to this day, the same families. It's very interesting. They were called Muranos, you may know that.
Yes.
And I have met some of those relatives abroad. It was very interesting. Not his, but the ones that changed. And it's very interesting, I think. Now that makes Henry and Babette. Was Babette born, and she came from Mannheim, where they were one of the leading Jewish families. And they came to America about, I guess, 1840, something like that. I think he didn't want to serve in the army, if I'm not mistaken, or his parents didn't want him. I don't know all the details.
That was the reason for many coming.
Oh, undoubtedly, yeah. Undoubtedly, but I'm not sure. That's
so what was the relation of this person?
Henry Lashanska?
Yes.
Well, he was my mother's father.
I see.
And Babette Born, who married him, was my mother's mother.
Maternal friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my grandmother, for whom I named, was her maiden name was Leonora Spiro.
Very interesting background.
Yes, we're quite international because
yes,
there's really some English, some Portuguese, some Spanish, some Dutch, some German, and some Czech.
Did your mother pursue a professional career very long?
Oh, yes.
I see.
She kept it up even after my father's death for about 7 years after this. And then she gave it up. And we always felt that was a great mistake because at that time, trying to remember the war years. It was in 19, I think it was towards the end of World War II, 1944-45, that she was offered the job through the Musicians Emergency Committee, to whom she'd been very generous in her lifetime in singing songs for various benefits to help young musicians get a chance. They were national in character, and they are saw to it that she was offered the post of heading the musical rehabilitation work for the whole country for veterans and hospitals, and we all wanted her to take it. but she wouldn't. She said she had worked extremely hard in her career. She'd had the terrible shock of being left a widow very young and had to raise two girls. As she said, it was probably one of the worst times in the world because there was still prohibition. Mm. Do you remember that?
I do.
And the answer was she was petrified. When we'd go out at night, we were, I guess, fairly attractive. And she felt being alone, she had to be extra strict. Mm-hmm. And she said that it was really difficult. And she said then to keep her career going, because she knew she needed to. She wanted to remain in her field as long as she felt she could. She did not want the huge responsibility that this job entailed. And so she refused it. And we always felt very badly about that. Because Mother was not only a very brilliant and talented woman. This is a picture over here on this wall, painted by some artist, I don't know. It wasn't terribly good. But this was when she was 23. She was a very beautiful woman, with black hair, big blue eyes, and a pure white skin. She was always taken for Irish wherever she went. And they would think, well, madam, you've probably married a Jew. And she would say, no, I'm Jewish too, and they never could believe it, because she had true Irish coloring. Well, anyway, my point is that in this particular case, we felt it was bad, her children and her two sons-in-law loved her very much, because they felt with this talent and this brain, and she had a terrific brain, great wit, and she was just a very remarkable personality as well as a great singer, that the country lost something, that she would have innovated certain things and also would have taken care of a lot of her energy, because when she didn't do this, then she sort of, shall we say, concentrated on her family, and sometimes we felt it was a little much.
But she felt that was what she needed to do, I'm sure.
Well, that's what she thought, but by that time we were grown, we weren't so sure, you see. But that was her choice, and we do not make other people's choices, right?
That's right. Well, then there were just the two, you and your sister.
That's right. She was my junior by 6 years.
Is there anything of special interest that we need to know about your sister?
Well, she's a leader in the community of New York.
I see.
She married Governor Lehman's oldest boy after just 6 months at college. Mother never forgave her for not even finishing the year, never. But anyway, they've been childhood sweethearts, and they got married, and he went off to war, and he was killed.
Oh, my.
Leaving her with two little children. One was, I think, 4, and the other was not quite 2, my nieces. And then a couple of years after his death, she married Richard K. Korn, who was the grandson of Mr. Charles K., who was also a New York leader. And Mr. Korn himself, Richard, was a musicologist and author of a number of books, and every hobby he had, he ended up teaching it, such as astronomy and other fields he was interested in over the years. And he was also the founder of the Orchestra of the Americas, which he ran for about 10 years.
Very versatile, Jim.
Oh, yes, and he was a great deal older. He was more my contemporary than my sister's, and he was a superb stepfather to those children. And a wonderful uncle, and so wonderful when my husband died, to me and my children, and the way he acted as a father. He was a marvelous man.
I'm sure there was much emphasis on music in your home.
That's the interesting thing. Not directly. I mean, probably that's one reason that we all love music so much, and that I was able to do this with my children. Mother never kept telling us it was good for us.
She never
was classic. She didn't do that. We were exposed to it continuously. Tickets to concerts, to symphonies, to recitals, whatever, oratorios. We met all the musical greats of that time because they were all friends or acquaintances of my mother. Mother was a well-known hostess and frequently gave big parties for some newcomer in the musical world to introduce him or her to the general leadership of the city. But by never telling us that we ought to like it, that it was good for us,
We all were exposed to it, and we loved it.
She was wise.
Oh, very wise. And without really thinking too much about it, since my husband and I both love music also, he not as much as I, but a great deal, we did pretty much the same thing with ours. There were tickets, they didn't have to go. We always played good music. You know, that makes a difference. It's what you hear around in the radio or your Victrola that makes the difference. And they all love music. In fact, one of them is in the field. My daughter is assistant professor of music at Duquesne University as a music therapist in their music therapy department, which is part of the music department. Has a lovely voice.
What's
and
your
uses
name?
It. Her name is Peggy Hulda Elkert. And she is carrying on. Her grandmother always said she had a beautiful voice. And I did sing for a time. I had a nice voice, but it was small. But I developed certain programs on radio when I came here that were broadcast over two-thirds of the Mutual Network. It was the history of American song. But before I mention that, I would tell you that both my sons love it. They go to concerts, and my younger son, my daughter's twin, is an opera buff par excellence. He knows every opera almost by heart, and he has learned all the male roles for no other reason but to sing perhaps in the shower or for a few friends. But he loves music very, very much.
Do you have any recordings of your mother?
Yes, but not here. They're up in my other home.
I see.
Of course, no, all the children have all of them.
How wonderful.
Richard, my brother-in-law, had them facsimile for us on tapes, that we all, every child and all of us, have practically everything she ever sang.
Was there any other cultural emphasis in your home? I mean,
yes.
Music indirectly, I
Not guess. Music. I mean, I think you can't live in New York and not love the theater and the opera. I mean, if you're at all interested in art, which we all were, and of course, there was the Metropolitan, and I was sent to lectures there on art. Perhaps even when I was too young, I was about 10, nevertheless, I enjoyed them immensely. And more than that, I think I went to a school that my grandfather founded that made a great emphasis on both the cultural and the regular academic work. It was the Ethical Culture Society. And my grandfather was one of the founders. And he helped to start the society and the school, which, of course, I went to. And the older branches became known as the Fieldston School. But the younger branch, that is the first branch for the younger children, the elementary school, was called and is still called the Ethical Culture School.
Yes, I'm familiar with
that. What was his name?
Selig, S-E-L-I-G, Rosenbaum. And, of course, he was a contemporary of Felix Adler and Professor Seligman, Edward Seligman, the great economist, who were also founders. John Lovejoy Elliott. All those people were his friends and helped with the school and were leaders in the school, and David Muzzy, the historian.
Oh, yes.
They were all part of that group, and I knew them all.
Was there any particular religious emphasis in your home?
Well, it was very interesting. They were very tolerant in that regard of each other. My father had gone to the Ethical Society earlier and was a trustee at the time of his death. And he did not go to temple. He didn't go to any church. He went to the society on Sunday. And that's where I heard Dr. Adler speak many times and Dr. Elliott. And Mother was devoted. She was, of course, a member of the Reformed Temple, Temple Emmanuel. She went there and had a pew until she died. And I went to temple with her occasionally, but I went to the society quite regularly. But neither side felt that the other side should be the one. It would be our own preference. And I know that I grew up feeling, because of Mother's deep devotion to going to temple, that I, for instance, would never go to a place of amusement on Yom Kippur out of respect for her and what she believed, though those things meant absolutely nothing to me. I didn't deny a respect for the tradition.
but they did not mean anything to me. But I can hand it to both of them that that's the way we were raised.
That's pretty remarkable.
Well, they were very remarkable.
That sounds that way, definitely.
Were you active in the Ethics Society here about 25 years
no,
ago?
No, I got to know a few of them, but there were too few to have a really
active group.
And what I did was, during the war years, I joined the Unitarian Church. And I joined it for a very good reason, at least it was good to me. And that was, I felt that there was far too great an emphasis on Zionism. Now, that has nothing to do with the need for a place for refugees, which we all worked for at the time and wanted to see more of. But it had to do with my feeling that religion must be separate from politics. That doesn't mean you don't hope you'll have a religious leader in your community, whether he's your rabbi or someone else's priest or minister, mm-hmm. who doesn't guide his congregation or hers, now we say hers, because I know two young girls who are ministers and they're both very able and very articulate. But it does mean that I would not want to go to a church where most of the time was spent talking about political things instead of spiritual and ethical things, and I could not stomach that. So I left the temple, and I never joined in New York either, and became a Unitarian when Reverend Murray was here.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think he's one of the finest men I ever knew. And he was absolutely brilliant, you know. He got his degree from Harvard when he was 16. Mm-hmm. Not too bad. But anyway, I felt that he had a knowledge of the world and a, I don't know how to describe it, an understanding of what ethics meant in the sense of working with your fellow man that appealed to somebody who'd been brought up in the ethical culture school.
A meaningful experience for you.
Yes, it was. Yeah. It was.
How would you describe the parental roles with regard to discipline or influence in your growing up years in your family?
Oh, I'd say they were pretty strict. Pretty strict. You must remember, when I grew up, you did not contradict your elders.
Hmm.
You might disagree with them, but you didn't contradict them. If it was a pleasant conversation, you could say, well, I don't believe this because, or I wish you wouldn't say that because, but you didn't directly contradict them. We had a rather charming, difficult Texas uncle. He was originally born in France and became the head of a big department store down in Texas. And he always came up every year, once a year. And he was extremely, shall we say, conservative. And I was then at college. And when I'd find I couldn't stand another word he said at dinner, I, knowing what my mother was thinking with the eyebrows going up, I'd always find that I had more homework to do so I could leave before I had contradicted him, and which would have been just unpardonable. Evidently, you've had the same experience.
Yeah,
so, I mean, you know, nowadays when you tell that to your kids, they don't believe you, but they better.
It's a different world.
It certainly is.
Do you have any observations or recollection on economic factors like depression years?
Oh, very
definitely. Was your family affected in any way?
Oh, sure. Every family was affected. What I remember, because I was so very young, my father had died. And I remember several kids in the school had fathers who killed themselves during the depression. Something had stayed in my mind. Mm-hmm. Also, I learned, which I was always grateful for, it was a terrible thing to learn, but I sometimes was able to help people because I learned it so very young. I learned to know what hunger looked like. The blue around the mouth and around the eye is a look that when you've learned that, you never can fail to recognize it. You just never can. And I certainly saw it. And there's an interesting story about my mother and the Depression, if you'd want to hear it. Even during the time when the banks were closed by Roosevelt. Remember the moratorium?
Yes, sir.
And I remember, I wondered how people could manage. Well, you know how we managed, because our German housekeeper didn't believe in banks, and she put all her money under her bed. So she loaned it to my mother.
I see.
That's how we had small change and small bills for the few weeks that the moratorium lasted. Well, anyway, even during the moratorium, my mother told the cook, now look here, Susie, there's so many hungry people. Remember, there was no WPA. There was nothing except what the churches and private places offered for bread lines. You did see people, and they had good overcoats, so you knew they came from a different class, that were selling apples in the street. And so my mother said to her, I'd like, if anyone comes to our door, and we had her, I told you I had a brownstone. They had downstairs a big sort of iron grill, and you could put packages and stuff through the sort of hole that was there, which you could lock up. She said, don't turn anyone away who comes for a cup of soup or a sandwich. You give them something. Don't worry. We've got to do this. Well, you know how grapevines spread with the poor or with anyone.
We did.
After about 2 weeks, we would have a line almost every day, and they all got either a cup of soup or coffee and a sandwich.
It kept them alive.